Welcome to Upvote, a politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. Each week until the election, we'll be discussing the increasingly important relationship between politics and technology, which more and more is coming to define political life. I'm Roland Manthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired. With me is Kelly Fireash, News Editor of Ars Technica.
Hello.
Later, we'll be discussing the Digital Economy Bill, which Kelly's been investigating. Kelly, how's that looking? Would you say it's strong and stable, or is it a coalition of chaos?
Well, Roland, it depends who you're asking, really. The Digital Economy Act 2017 is a massive piece of legislation. It really pulls in so many different strands of what some might describe as the digital economy, but others might just say that this is the Tories trying their best to police more of the internet, with very mixed results. And the other key thing is that it was rushed through Parliament to meet the deadline before the general election. And implementing this piece of law after the election is going to be tricky for whichever government comes in next.
Yes, it's what Boris Johnson might call an onion-eyed snout band, or something like that.
Yep, or maybe it's a ham-fisted fuss budget, who knows?
Who knows indeed. More on that later. First though, we're now a bit under 2 weeks into the campaign, and let's face it, so far we've learnt relatively little. There are two narratives that are generally getting repeated. One is that this is the most important election since the Second World War, possibly ever. The other is that it's actually relatively boring, because the result is a foregone conclusion. Of course, we thought that in 2015, when everyone was convinced there was going to be a hung parliament, not least David Cameron and George Osborne, who stuffed their manifesto with pledges to trade away in coalition negotiations, including, some say, the promise of a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union, which, of course, got us to where we are today. So, politics is unpredictable. And if we've learned anything over the last few years, it's that one big source of unpredictability is social media. So, what's going on in the world of Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, etc.? To discuss this question, we're joined by Carl Miller, Research Director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media, which is part of the think tank Demos. Hello, Carl.
Hello there.
And Louis Knight-Webb, who's tech lead at Who Targets Me, a new startup tracking political advertising on Facebook. Hi, Louis.
Hello.
That's after this from our friends at Pickfair. Pickfair is where a new generation of photographers sell images to businesses across the globe. You know the iPhone posters? Those shots taken on an iPhone 6? Well, they're sold on Pickfair. If your business is looking for stunning, authentic images to use for your website, or your marketing, or social media and blogs, Pickfair doesn't force you into a subscription or make you buy credits. You can just head to the website and buy them off the shelf. And they're affordable too. Images start from £1 to license. And best of all, Pickfair is fair. They're the only image licensing platform that ensures the photographers see the vast majority of the money generated by their images. Head to pickfair.com, that's P-I-C-F-A-I-R, for images that will set your business apart. And now on with the show. Social media. Let's start with Twitter. Carl, you've been tracking political activity on Twitter for several years. What have you found out about the way it affects politics?
Well, what has been clear throughout all the years we've been looking at Twitter is that it's of course, a increasingly important digital battleground. You know, ever since 2008 and the Obama elections then and into 2012, campaigns all over the world have known that it's a important digital turf they need to be on, they need to try and dominate, that they need to get their message out there and that they need to reach people. But really, I think that Twitter, as opposed to the other social media platforms, has always really been about galvanising your own core base. It's always been about getting your own volunteers, your own party faithful, excited, energised and out there on the streets. But then, of course, you know, underlying that, there is this massive concern that one of the big things that social media is really, and certainly Twitter also, is doing to politics is actually making it nastier, making it more febrile, making it more abusive, and with the rise of echo chambers, also making it more polarised. So we've both seen it, really, throughout all of our work at Demos over the years, we've been looking at digital politics as being an amazing new way in which people are engaging with politics, and an amazing new way in which people that have otherwise had nothing to do with Westminster, nothing to do with any of the mainstream parties or politicians or hustling events or any of the offline things that parties do to try and get people involved, are suddenly having something to do with politics for the first time. Suddenly they're out there on social media asking politicians questions and chipping in to this new, rolling, sometimes very chaotic, but certainly very important digital public debate, which is now happening. But then also we've been tracking all the problems, be it female journalists being shouted down, echo chambers and polarity, which digital politics is also introducing for the first time.
So politically, What works on Twitter? What's effective from the point of view of a political party?
I think kind of there is one really clear thing that we've seen, and that is that politicians do really well on social media when they show their human side. So Nick Clegg, believe it or not, had one of the greatest moments in 2015 when he went on the last leg. He threw a melon at somebody. He said he wanted to slap Boris Johnson in his face, and social media absolutely loved that. Likewise, we covered the Irish elections thereafter, and one of the most powerful people in Irish politics is there's a few of them, but it was really the Sinn Féin politicians that kind of showed their kind of humorous sides. You know, they were tweeting puns, they were tweeting the yokes on me. You know, I mean, it was people that were kind of talking about their family and in a sense kind of using social media as not only another channel but a new kind of channel where outside of mainstream journalists and outside of those kind of, you know, soundbite pieces on BBC News, they got to show who they really were. And people reacted much, much better to that than they ever did to any of this kind of bland, airbrushed, PR-facing electioneering that we sometimes also see on social media and on Twitter.
Which of the parties does best on Twitter, would you say?
Well, it depends what you mean by best there, Roland. I mean, like, there's very visible and very invisible sides of digital politics. So in terms of visibility, of course, this is all about messaging. It's about framing elections. It's about telling people what elections really are about. And you always see political parties endlessly going on over some themes rather than others. So last time, was it really about the economy? Or was it really about saving the NHS? In terms of messaging, and speaking now for Twitter, Labour really were the party of the digital volunteer. You know, as they had millions of people going out in the streets, they were much more active than any other party on Twitter. They were sending many more messages, more of their MPs were involved, and more of their volunteers and kind of party faithful too. But the kind of invisible side of all of this is the way in which social media produces all that amazing new data which campaigns use for decision making and use for targeting. You'll hear more about targeting, I think, in a minute. But there's a kind of invisible kind of data architecture rumbling underneath every campaign now. They're using it more and more to understand what people are talking about, how they're reacting to key messages, how they're reacting to key events like manifesto launches. And I think increasingly, and we saw this a lot with Obama in 2012, I think we're seeing social media in that invisible way being used for decision-making at the very core of campaigns. So obviously mixing with other kinds of data, proprietary data, data that the parties themselves hold, open source data, mixing that all up. And from that, getting a very, very granular, very specific view of what kind of voters they need to reach. And then from that, making decisions around resourcing, about where to send their politicians, and all, of course, about messaging to work out how they get those that precious commodity in every election, the floating voter in the swing constituency on their side.
What happened during the 2015 general election then? And are there lessons for how political party campaigns are going to operate this time around?
One of the lessons for me was that, you know, as I was covering this as almost like a kind of data journalist in 2015, we were only covering the bits that were really visible. So every week we would be writing about how the anti-establishment parties were really visible, how they're really taking on the kind of Westminster consensus, how Labour was the most active of them all. And what we really didn't see was that invisible side I've just been talking about. We really didn't see the Conservative Party using that targeting in really effective ways to just contact those swing voters in those key marginals again and again and again and again with the same messaging. Constantly testing those messages, working out which ones were getting the right reaction. And from that, probably in ways which we couldn't actually measure at the time, really squeezing a lot of value, maybe even more value than the visible side out of their digital election campaign. I say that just the other thing that we did learn, and we only learned this again in the aftermath. I mean, during campaigns, the actual campaigns themselves are obviously notoriously secretive. This is like a war. You know, everyone's looking for a new tactic. But what we did see was the way in which people were using social media to raise money and volunteers and really kind of get tangible outcomes.
And speaking of the secret side, that brings us to Facebook.
Yeah.
Often thought of as the secret area of social media. Mm. I mean, so Louis, explain a bit what you're doing with Who Targets Me.
Yeah, so Who Targets Me is a citizen-led project to understand digital political adverts better. We're working out who's advertising, what messages they're using, how messages change. You know, there's lots of different types of personality you can tweak your messaging to, And we're making the data available to audit, which has never been done before. The Facebook's advertising means that I can't tell what adverts you're seeing, you can't tell what adverts I'm seeing, and nobody can really fact check or perform any analysis on it. So this is in response to that, and what we've done is create a browser extension that every time you browse Facebook, it works in the background, scans your newsfeed, picks out the adverts, sends them to our servers. We categorize them, tag them by political party, spit the statistics back out at you, and you can see exactly who is targeting you.
So, who is targeting people at the moment?
So, well, we've seen activity from all the major parties. It's useful to say that we, you know, it's relatively small sample size so far, having launched last week, but we've seen most activity by the Labour Party. They are driving people to vote, and they're targeting generally young people, which is consistent with their 12% voter increase from in the 18 to 24-year-olds from 2015 on 2010.
Because on Facebook, you can target someone really precisely according to their age, can't you?
Exactly.
I mean, you can actually target a 19-year-old?
Yeah, so you can target to a huge multitude of variables. You can target vegetarians, and you can say, yeah, we're going to advocate for rights for animals and things like that. And the spooky thing is that, you know, you can't even tell. You can't even ask Facebook, why are you targeting me? They'll only spit out very basic information like, you know, we're targeting 18 to 50-year-olds in the UK. And that's really, you know, not very useful when you're trying to work out why people are receiving the messages they are.
And the other thing you've seen is a lot of crowd-funded campaigns like More United,
yeah,
which we actually touched on last week with their backer, Martha Lane Fox. They are really going for it on Facebook.
They are. They're definitely pointing people straight to their donation pages with messages like, you know, create a better Britain and stronger in Britain, things like that, definitely, from More United and Best for Britain, yeah.
So what's the regulation in this area? What's the Electoral Commission saying about a campaign like you?
So one of the outcomes that we would like to achieve is better regulation of online digital political advertising. TV was really highly regulated in 2003. You've got party political broadcasts and no other type of political advertising is on TV. Why shouldn't we have the same for Facebook advertising? Right now they've got, it's counted in their entire local budget, so they've got up to $15,000 per constituency to spend on Facebook advertising, and we would like to see this reduced and the messages that people are sending audited.
What kind of response are you seeing from voters? I know that this is early days at the moment, but what's the response?
So far we've had tons of people, volunteers themselves, getting behind the project. We've had, you know, developers come on board, legal help. It's really been overwhelming to, you know, the media's united behind us. It's something that everybody's aware of. You know, recently there's a lot of buzzwords like Cambridge Analytica flying around, and people would really like to understand that data more. And this is the start of a conversation that is going to take us months to analyse and understand the data properly. But, you know, hopefully we'll be working with lots of people, lots of research institutes, journalists, investigative journalists, to find out exactly what the stories are. So it's early days.
Okay, and you were quick to kind of get this out the door, I gather.
Yeah. I found out about the project last Friday, built it on the weekend, basically stayed up all night. And launched it with a great guy called Sam Jeffers, who pitched the idea at Newspeak House. And it's been a week, and we've got half the country accounted for now. So.
And for you, it's important that this isn't a political exercise. You're not partisan.
No, not at all. My interest is in transparency. We've had lots of groups approach us about using the data for political campaigns. People have tried to buy the data off us. It's not going to happen. Basically, we are here for transparency, and anybody that wants to do analysis on the data is welcome to.
Okay.
Does social media work? I guess what I'm thinking really here is that we've been told that it's going to be the social media election. I think the first one was 2010 maybe, and then 2015 was going to be again, and I'm pretty sure Brexit was going to be too. But really, if you think about it, maybe you can speak to this, that the influence of the tabloids and the mainstream media, they seem to be really the main thing that drives politics in terms of at least media.
If I had a pound every time I was asked whether an election was a social media election.
but really, is it this time?
I think the real question to ask is this going to be the hacked election? That's what I'm more worried about. So, it's fiendishly difficult to work out which particular part of a campaign really matters. Because the problem is that we don't have lab conditions here. Everything is flying at voters all at once. And all at the same time. Now, what we do know is that in 2015, for young people, they said that social media was the second most important thing that they were going to base their vote on after the TV debates. And the TV debates, obviously, sadly, in my view, now aren't happening. So I can really see that social media is obviously creeping in. It's obviously becoming just gradually more and more influential and important each time. Look, I mean, if online advertising didn't work, Google wouldn't be the company that it is, and neither would Facebook. So there is something there in highly targeted ads at people which really changes their behaviour.
Because there's kind of, Louis, you alluded to it, the myth of Cambridge Analytica, right? Yeah. That we know that maybe they did something and maybe it really worked.
So we're tracking exactly which messages are working. We can pull out things like the number of likes and look at the comments that adverts are getting and see exactly which messages are getting the most traction with voters. And we might find that it's particularly aggressive messaging and, you know, things like that. We'll find out.
Because one area where it was really meant to work was Brexit, right? Because I'm sure you know Dominic Cummings, who's the campaign director at Vote Leave. And after the referendum, he wrote this really like long thing explaining how they'd done it. And basically, it was we put all our money into digital, and it was mainly on Facebook. And wave of the magic wand, this was how it happened. We were targeting people in a really, really precise way. I mean, Carl, you looked at Brexit, right?
Mm.
Was that a social media referendum?
There is this ritual at the end of every campaign when everyone fights to get in front of the spotlight and show how amazing their campaign strategy and tactics were. And you know what? Privately, campaigners have said to me that they really doubt how powerful campaigns in their entirety actually are. I mean, personally, I think the campaigns maybe shift one or two points in either direction. And most important there is framing the election, what it's really about. But what campaigns can't really do is change the political position and the nature of the candidates themselves. And Obama's the best example of this. Okay, so, I mean, Obama, yes, he did use social media brilliantly in 2008 to reach people. He used it again brilliantly in 2012 to make decisions. But what he did most brilliantly of all was to make himself the digital candidate. He changed who he was. He kind of branded himself as being this kind of future-facing, kind of digital kind of symbol for what the United States could become. And that, I think, was more powerful than anything that they did in terms of data-driven decision-making or messaging. You know, so I think we often obsess too much over campaigns, to be honest, and not enough about the actual candidates behind them. And that's one of the real powers that that the digital world has.
Okay, I mean, it's long been known that the internet is stuffed full of things that aren't true. So what's changed now? Are botnets out of control?
Oh, well, you have to read my excellent piece in the next edition of Wired, I think, and others.
Well plugged.
So there is a whole world out there of disinformation on demand. A couple of clicks and you're on a dark market and you can buy a massive array of different disinformation products, all the way through from the cheap and cheerful botnets all the way to expensive, discreet and bespoke services. I think that what really is most worrying is that the kind of internet now allows this new kind of lie to happen. So we've always had disinformation. We've always had politicians saying things which aren't necessarily true. We've always had journalists getting stuff wrong. There's always been disinformation. But now, yeah, that's true, Roland. There has been journalists getting stuff wrong too.
What?
Surely not.
But now the really scary thing is that you can pretend to be the crowd to influence the crowd. That's the new thing. So you could pretend to be these 10,000 people, these comment posts, you know, these Facebook groups, and none of that is true. And that's a new thing. So no one's previously been able to fake an entire crowd around you to get you to change your behaviour. Now they can. And we know social scientifically that is a really powerful thing to do. So human beings mimic each other. They tend to move along with standards and norms that they see others that hold. So crowds really, really affect us. They affect our beliefs. And that's what that's the newest, sharpest edge of disinformation that I'm most worried about.
And for you, Louis, looking at the stats on Facebook and the kind of targeted ads that you're seeing there? Yeah. I mean, what kind of trends are you spotting in terms of misinformation?
Yeah. In terms of misinformation, not much so far. You know, there's a couple of satire groups like Green Party memes popping up and things like that. And it's about being clear who is endorsed by a political party and who is just somebody that's put something on social media and boosted it themselves, you know, just put their own credit card on. We need to be adding things like, you know, the watermark that lets people know that something is endorsed by a political party. That's currently not appearing on social media adverts, although it does in leaflets and on TV. We definitely need better information about what is real fact, you know, especially when it comes to advertising. Yeah.
Because I hate to be the first one to mention fake news. Well, the reason I hate to be...
Someone had to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the reason I hate to is because it's a terrible term and it doesn't really exist and it doesn't really mean anything. And in fact, the fact that it doesn't mean anything is a problem when it comes to dealing with it. I mean, you know, are you talking about state-sponsored propaganda or general disinformation or just confusion? But in the US, the debate around social media was completely dominated by fake news. And I guess especially this idea that there were groups dedicated to influencing people in a misleading direction, let's say. So I have to ask, have either of you seen any kind of evidence? Carl, have you seen any evidence of this in the UK on Twitter? Or because there is a theory that the UK is less susceptible to so-called fake news because we already have a very partisan media.
Well, I mean, I hadn't quite thought about it that way, Ryan. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
There's some BuzzFeed work on this. Yeah, they looked at kind of the studies of... I think they just looked at a bunch of kind of people and saw how susceptible they were to fake news, and they said, no, it's okay, we've got the tabloid, so we're fine, thanks.
To be honest with you, I haven't seen much sign of it either yet. This is something that we're beginning to look at. We're trying to apply kind of machine learning, kind of analytic techniques to try and detect fake news over the next 4 or 5 weeks. Really the kind of like the underlying concern at the moment isn't that it's specifically there, it's that people can produce it so easily. You know, so the underlying capabilities of all creating disinformation, gaming online reputation systems, making stuff really visible when it shouldn't be, making stuff look really popular when it isn't, all of that is there. And as these kind of, you know, as social media platforms become more and more important in determining what we see and what we think, we've really got to get better, not only the society, but also the social media platforms, of course, themselves, in working out how we deal with this kind of gaming. You know, I mean, go on Black Hat SEO world. You know, you can see there's forums raging about the best ways of Google bombing, the best ways of gaming search engine results. You know, when you really begin to seriously look at this kind of stuff, you see how seriously other people are looking at it and presumably using it as well. There's big money in all of this.
Well, in a way, that's just the nature of the internet right now, isn't it? I mean, you know, when we publish an article online, we spend 10 minutes getting it right for SEO. There's a fine line between gaming and just making yourself visible, and I mean, no one's entirely clear what it is. But anyway, I mean, because Facebook is always thought to be kind of the area where the cleaner area, mm-hmm. where this doesn't really go on. I mean, we were looking at some ads earlier, and you were just saying how that you don't mind the ads there. They're kind of they fit in.
They
naturally
fit in, you know, you've got like you're looking at an advert and it says your friends like this page, and the adverts on Facebook fit into this strange intersection of endorsement by the community. You've got likes, you've got comments, your friends are, you know, is it really an advert? It's something that really needs to be researched. Back to fake news, I think the scary thing is we haven't seen any fake news from any of the adverts that we've tracked so far. But that's the thing, fake news doesn't even need to be sponsored to get out there, right? People just share it themselves. It doesn't need cash behind it. So
yeah, it's what's called in the trade native content.
Yeah.
So Louis and Carl, if you can talk a bit more about filter bubbles and the effect that they're having on campaigns such as the current general election, but also the referendum as well. I mean, are we too busy talking to ourselves online?
I suspect that we are. We know that filter bubbles exist, although there's very little empirical evidence actually to allow you as a researcher to really define what a filter bubble is and what isn't. So, like, from the research world here, and as a Moni researcher for a second, we're very kind of we're very far behind the kind of general public anxiety about echo chambers and filter bubbles in the way that we can actually go out and measure and detect them and understand the impact that they're having. From social science, though, we know that there are basically two things that happen when you, in general, get your worldviews confirmed again and again and again and again in a thousand different ways, and this is what filter bubbles end up doing. Firstly, you become more and more convinced that your point of view is right. And secondly, you, as a result of that, you become more convinced that your opponents are either ignorant or evil. So arguably, I mean, and I think that politics is becoming more polarised and angry for lots of different reasons, and many of them don't have anything to do with the internet whatsoever. But partly you can see that the if that were the effect of echo chambers, and if the effect of echo chambers were to be widespread, as we kind of suppose they are, then politics is becoming angrier, and our capacity for civil disagreement, our capacity for this kind of respectful middle ground of political debate is diminishing, as people basically can less and less understand why the people on the other side of an issue really, how could they possibly disagree with me? You know, when all the facts and all the evidence and all the opinions I've seen point in one direction, and only one direction.
Why do you think we haven't seen a Trump or a Modi figure in the UK? Because, I mean,
have we not?
Yeah, well, I guess, well, we haven't seen someone who's kind of been propelled to an astonishing rise by basically saying angry things on social media. I mean, why? What were you thinking of? Were you thinking of...
I was just thinking the rise of the, you know, the far right. I mean, it's prevalent, but you're talking about as an actual figure rather than a political movement, a kind of somebody that's coming as a Trump strong man kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess. What I was talking about is using that energy to and taking it into mainstream politics. But why? Because do you think that we've seen the rise of a far right kind of via social media in the same way that we think we have in the US? Although it's always very unclear.
Not to the extent certainly that you're seeing in the US, but I think you know we're at risk of certainly.
Really, Carl? Because you did some interesting work on Islamophobia, didn't you, on Twitter?
Well, I've been predicting this for years, and as yet, of course, events have proven me wrong, but I'll continue to predict this. I think that in 2020, the political landscape will look distinctly different from what it does today. And I think that in that time, there will be somebody who comes completely outside of politics, who mixes together elements from left and right, from different political parties, brings in a whole body of issues which nobody's even spoken about, and will use social media to really take on the mainstream political parties. There's very little tying people to those mainstream political parties at the moment, and those ties are getting less and less.
I've got one name for you, and if you don't all spontaneously vomit on hearing this, then I'll be surprised. And that name is Katie Hopkins. Well, but in a way, it's a bit, if you think of like someone who's got gigantic reach, and and just kind of says the most outrageous things, then I mean, Katie Hopkins, could we, Carl? I wish I'd never even had this thought.
Personally, we couldn't. I don't think it can be someone that divisive. If you look at say Beppe Grillo in Italy, there's somebody who makes kind of anti-corruption his key platform, and in doing that kind of actually says something which people from across the political spectrum in Italy could agree with. So I don't think it will be anyone that divisive. And I don't think it will just be someone who exploits one of the kind of basic new realities of politics, which is that social media and the digital world in general has radically declined the kind of barriers to entry into political life. So you don't need to have you don't need business funders anymore. You don't need a party organisation. You don't need contacts in the press and in journalism in order to kind of boost your profile. I mean, Beppe Grillo showed us all of this. He refused to speak to the newspapers. He built a political party online in a year, and he had the most popular blog in Italy. And the Five Star Movement, his party he then formed, was funded by small donations. So it's just become so much easier to take on the mainstream. And that's why I still sincerely believe that there's going to be some big disruptive impact in British politics over the next couple of years.
Yeah, because Grillo's an interesting example, isn't he? Because with the case of Trump, what he had was fame, existing fame. He already had a huge social media presence, and then he was able to turn that into political success. In fact, he wasn't really a social media candidate; he was a reality TV candidate. But Grillo is an example of someone who, I mean, yeah, he was well known, right? But, you know, only as about as well known as, who's a comedian in the UK? Lee Hurst? He has repellent views on Twitter. but yeah, so it's quite an interesting example, actually. Although, as you say, I mean, I've heard you predict this before, so who knows if that deep inertia of British politics won't prevent it.
Well, we also have the issue where we are still looking at a very old electoral system. So I think, as much as anything, perhaps there's a whole issue here about electoral reform. And so it's much harder for politics in this country to be purely personality driven, and it's much more about the movement. So how can that change from a grassroots level online?
It's a really good question. And yeah, the kind of first past the post system is definitely one of the reasons that we haven't seen the same kind of political tumult as we have across a lot of the a lot of Europe. I think despite what the outcome of this election is likely to be, I think in general we are entering an era where there's going to be more coalitions, there's going to be more kind of alliances, there's going to be a much more kind of rainbow pattern. You know, micro organisations really benefit from the digital revolution. You know, that it's much easier for them to form, but they're also more agile. They're quicker, and they can have massively kind of force multiplied impacts that they couldn't have before. So, in many ways, like political parties, much like kind of businesses or all other kinds of groups, you know, don't benefit from being these large, hierarchical, centralised institutions. You know, in many ways, they, like lots of other kinds of institutions across, you know, public, private and third sector life, are struggling to kind of deal with these new kind of anti-establishment, agile, kind of micro-organisational usurpers.
Carl, where can we go to check out your research?
You can go... You can go to the Demos website, or you can follow me on Twitter, or you can, I'll be releasing a book in a few months' time as well, so you can hopefully read that too.
Okay. Right, and Louis, because where can we see your work? And also, have you got any examples of ads that you've seen? Because on the theme that, you know, all politics is essentially local, it would be interesting to know if you've got any just nice kind of little ones in a constituency somewhere that we don't know about.
So there's certainly local candidates that are starting to pop up. They've got quite, you know, cheesy messages. I don't want to give specific examples, but we've seen about, you know, four of those. On the national level, we've seen Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem all campaigning. So, yeah.
Okay. Are you sure we can't hear some of the... there's a couple of nice ones. No, he's shaking his head. Because anyone can sign up to your website and download the browser.
They can.
And that will add to your pool of data, which you will, of course, protect incredibly carefully.
Yeah, well, you'll be contributing as a volunteer. So you go to whotargets.me or follow us on Twitter at whotargetsme.
Now for something slightly different. The work of actual government, which, to some people's surprise, is still going on this week. Kelly, you've been looking at the Digital Economy Act 2017, which I think is its full title.
That's correct, Roland.
Thank you. I got it right.
You got it.
Yeah. What is this? What is going on?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. Government has just completed this particular piece of legislation's journey through Parliament. It was rushed through in a so-called wash-up period, which basically means that it's to kind of get the legislation across the finish line before Parliament breaks up and, they go into election mode and campaigning mode. And it means that when whichever new government returns, and obviously it could be Theresa May, could be someone else, they will then have this huge and really quite unwieldy piece of legislation to deal with. That tries to tackle lots of different aspects of the tech world. And, you know, there are many businesses out there, be them ISPs or, maybe a porn site operator, for example, who are already complaining loudly that a lot of these provisions are going to be very difficult to implement.
Yeah, because the way I think about this is that it's a bit like your holiday that you have to take at work. You can't pass it over. So you have to take it in a rush at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That's sort of about right, isn't it?
That's pretty spot on.
Okay, yeah. Great. And then because essentially this bill is an attempt to a kind of catch-all for all the bits of the world that you might include in the digital economy. Everything from telcos to porn, which is, I also believe, included.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like a ball rolling down a hill and it's collecting fluff and leaves as it goes along, you know. And it kind of, some of it started with Cameron and his desire to, you know, regulate porn sites and so on to kind of prevent the prying eyes of kids from seeing stuff that they shouldn't supposedly be seeing at a young age. So, you know, that's one aspect of it. But then there's also been another thing that's been really locked into this piece of legislation, which is the data sharing aspects, which are really worrying a lot of privacy campaigners. And while it's true that medical researchers, for example, it's very helpful for them to be able to use our data and, you know, do things, do wonderful things like cure cancer and, you know, who knows what it might be useful for down the line. The issue with it is that there are a lack of safeguards. And there were promises made that there would be codes of practice that would be brought in to kind of try and pacify these concerns. But actually, partly because of the 11-hour nature of this legislation, that hasn't happened yet.
So the funny thing about this is that we've actually been here before, haven't we?
We have.
A great big digital economy bill was rushed through just before an election. Well, what happened last time round?
That's correct, yeah. So this was actually under Gordon Brown's government, so the Labour government in 2010. And the general election was called at that point, and this piece of legislation, so it was the Digital Economy Act 2010, was also at the final stages in Parliament, but still kind of needed some fine-tuning, if you like. But unfortunately, it didn't really get to that point because it had to be rushed through in the wash-up in order to ensure that that piece of legislation would be enacted before Parliament broke up. The end result of that was really for a piece of legislation that under the Tories and the Lib Dems, when they had their coalition government, it kind of struggled to be implemented. There was legal action as well, all sorts of concerns of it. And it's partly because a big red pen needed to be applied to the fine detail.
Yes, it's amazing, and in defiance of every working practice I've pursued throughout my entire life, that doing things at the last minute doesn't actually produce the best results.
No.
Yes.
No. Certainly yes. Not when you're in Parliament.
Yes, exactly.
And you're a lawmaker, and you've had, you know, the way this process works as well is that it goes through both houses. There's lots of discussions, there's committees, you know, various witnesses come and go, and give evidence that professionals, they're experts, they really know the field, and they're helping to develop these important pieces of law. So arguably there is enough time, but when it gets to the end and something else gets in the way and it's rushed like this, nobody's satisfied.
And just to give one example of what this means, so this plan for age verification checks for porn sites, mm-hmm. sounds like a good idea in theory, but a lot of people think it's unworkable.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, setting aside issues such as VPN, for example, so anyone with just a tiny bit of technical knowledge will kind of know how to work around systems like that. But also, many of the porn sites are hosted overseas. They're not even here. So to expect websites based all over the world to be regulated here, it's just not realistic. And that's one of the reasons why one of the kind of last-minute amendments that came in from the Tory government was to finally force the ISPs to actually block these sites at a network level. And this is also something that's really upset a lot of the telcos here, because, again, they feel like, why are they having to kind of take up the slack for something that's very difficult to police?
To ask a potentially stupid question, why does everything like this get lumped under the heading of digital economy?
It's a very good question, Roland, and I wish I knew the answer. I think it's just, it suggests to me that it's partly to do with politicians of all stripes not really being able to grapple with the tech world very effectively, and they still struggle with policy in this area. I think it's partly because they're users of these systems at a kind of consumer level, and that they see their kids and family members and so on using this tech. But it's not really like it's an equivalent to, say, other services that we use maybe transport, for example, where, you know, that's been around for a lot longer, and so that's something where the policy, they can build on that because of the history of it being around for a while. But maybe I'm being too fair to politicians here. The reality is that it's big business now, and it has been for some time. And, you know, it feels like there is a censorship battle here as much as a kind of morality thing going on. And it's very difficult to kind of try and legislate on those different topics.
Well, more to come on this in the future, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
So we'll be back next week with more from the ever larger Venn intersection between tech and politics. In the meantime, if you want to learn more about anything we've talked about on the podcast, including Carl's research, his book, and his many articles for Wired, all of which are excellent, Who Targets Me, and Kelly's reporting, of course, on the Digital Economy Bill, check out wired.co.uk and arstechnica.co.uk. Until then, it's goodbye from Kelly.
Goodbye. I'm off for a strong and stable cup of tea now.
Very nice. Goodbye from Carl.
Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for having me on.
Goodbye from Louis.
Yeah, goodbye. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, pleasure. And goodbye from me. Goodbye.